This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Many voters are looking forward to the televised presidential debates this election year. But true debaters would argue that the civil discourse of our times has given up on debate. What we see on TV is just politicians bashing each other. Because true debate has an air of openness, there is the possibility that minds can change on the strength of a well-crafted argument. Wake Forest University has an award-winning debate team. Their competition season is about to start, so we invited them on the show to talk more about it. Jared Atchison is the director of debate at Wake Forest University, also assistant professor in the communications department. And Melvin Washington is a junior at Wake Forest University and a competitive debater. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad
to be here. Excited to be here.
Good to have you here. So, Jared, tell me about the success. Wake Forest is a pretty successful award-winning debate team.
Absolutely. The university started in 1834, and the debate team started in 1835. We're one of the oldest student organizations on campus. Three national championships, two second-place finishes, five Final Four appearances, and the list goes on and on. So one of the most successful parts of Wake Forest's community.
Melvin, did debate and the success of Wake Forest have anything to do with your coming here?
Debate had a huge role in me coming here because of the fact that it, first of all, put Wake Forest on the map for me. I originally came to Wake for a debate camp, and I was just amazed at the culture of Wake Forest in and of itself and the debate team. That opened my eyes to the scholarship opportunities that they have here, and like I said, didn't look back from there.
You're from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So you
yes,
traveled
sir.
The distance to be here. Did you debate in high school?
Yes, I did. I debated at Fort Lauderdale High School under Mr. Jim Wakefield. Phenomenal program. Great people. Somewhat like Wake Debate.
So, Jared, let's go back to get a little bit of the history of debate. Talk about how it evolved as a competition and why we see it as a kind of academic discipline.
Well, when it started in the early period in 1834 and going forward, it was mostly literary societies on campuses that would debate each other. There wasn't a whole lot of debating against other universities early on. Our first contract debates that we can trace through our history take place from a Chamber of Commerce-sponsored debate by the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, Wake Forest against Duke, which was then Trinity University. They had a five-part debate series. Wake Forest won 3 out of 5, and the Dukies pulled out and said that they thought the judging was biased.
You cheated.
Absolutely. After that, the contract debates, for economic reasons, turned into tournaments because it became far more cost-effective to have universities meet in one location rather than trying to travel to see each other. And the tournaments sprung national championships as everyone wanted to see who was the best of the best. And in 1947, the National Debate Tournament was founded at West Point. And they hosted the National Debate Tournament, which is what we shoot for today as our end-of-the-year championship.
How is a tournament structured?
You have preliminary rounds where debaters have to debate both sides of the topic. And we have one topic for the whole year. So you have an equal number of debates for the proposition and equal number of debates against it. Then after those preliminary debates, they take the top-seeded teams, just like an NCAA bracket. We have single elimination, win and keep going, lose and go home, all the way through to a final round where the top two teams taking each other on.
So does a single debater have to debate both sides in a single day?
Absolutely. They'll have to do it multiple times in a single day. Yes.
And they have to take either side of the issue. So they have
Absolutely.
To be on one side of the issue. So Melvin, how do you prepare for a debate?
Well, preparation starts long before the season, actually. So you get the topic over the summer. And the way you prepare is primarily by doing research, talking to, you know, professors, talking to your debate coaches, talking to your partners, et cetera, and just trying to find out more about the topic, what you feel or what you think are the best arguments and what do you think is the best argumentative strategy. And you just go from there.
And it's not just forgive me for interrupting,
no
but
problem.
It's not just a generic topic. There is a resolution,
of
a
course.
Statement, and it's
of
a
course.
Yes or no on that statement. So then, as you say, you do a lot of research, and
yes.
then you have to build an argument.
Yes. So different people have different ways of building arguments. So personally, the way I build arguments is I look for what issues relevant to the topic are most connected to myself, because I feel like it's a lot easier to be passionate and a lot easier to craft strategic and, you know, true arguments based on things that, you know, you believe to be fundamentally true. So, for example, with the current energy topic, to abbreviate the resolution, it's to provide or to increase financial incentives or to reduce restrictions on a variety of energies. So the way I connected to the topic personally was the lack of participation by people of color and low-income people in the new green economy. So that's where that was my starting point for my research.
But you talked about passion, and you say that's your starting point.
Mm-hmm.
you have to debate both sides of this. So you have to be on the other side, which you feel perhaps passionate about, but you don't agree with.
That's the beauty of debate. It teaches you to separate logic and to use logic. You know, so you may feel strongly about one issue, but you have to be able to see the other side of the resolution of the issue as well, right? And that's the best way to get a holistic mode of education, right? Because if you have to see the issue from both sides, then you start to understand other perspectives, which is one of the reasons why debate is great for society and students and scholars in general, because it breeds things like tolerance. Because it's a lot easier for you to, you know, understand and tolerate someone who doesn't agree with you if you know where they're coming from, so to speak.
Logic. Because they don't do that in politics, you know. They really don't use it at all. In fact, you lose a lot of elections if you do. So if we go back, let's stick with that joke for a minute. The Lincoln-Douglas debates, mm-hmm. for instance, were they real debates? And were people – I mean, was there a time when people actually sort of logically weighed these things? And that kind of discourse mattered in the outcome of an election?
I think it did. And David Zaresky has a phenomenal book on the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I mean, hours-long debates in public over essential questions. Most people forget that they were passionate. At one point in time, Abraham Lincoln had to be restrained by the audience over a question he thought was inappropriate and a challenge from Douglas. So very passionate, very long debates. I don't know that I've always bought into the narrative that for some reason times have changed so dramatically that there weren't ideological passions that would have trumped logic, because I think that may be something persistent in public society. However, that being said, they were much longer and much different than what we see today in the 90-second answers that the average politician is given.
In a tournament, in competition, how important is the logic and how important is the charism of the debater, the ability to deliver a good speech?
That's an excellent question. At the end of the day, this is a persuasion activity. Different types of debate, however, emphasize different points of persuasion. This particular type of debate is designed around a ton of complicated policy research that undergraduates do outside of the classroom on their own time, and often cases, they only have 9 minutes to articulate their position. So in this form of debate, the persuasion parts of it in terms of teaching people traditional public speaking models have been subverted in the name of trying to help increase the focus on logic, research. So the average person might not follow a debate at the highest levels of intercollegiate debate in the same way they may not follow a scholarly article, despite the fact that what's being achieved in that moment is far more educational.
But that's what the judges are looking for,
exactly.
Or listening for.
Everything in persuasion is about the audience. And the audience in this situation is not the lay public. The audience is trained argument professionals, professors, scholars, people who are who have the background to judge one of these complicated debates.
Melvin, have you ever, in researching a topic, changed your mind because the logic was so persuasive on a side that you hadn't started on? You're young. It doesn't have to have happened yet.
Of course. Let's see. When I first started out debating in high school, for example, this has more so to do with international policy. I didn't necessarily have the best view of U.S. hegemony, correct? Or, just our current mode of international politics, the way we operate on the geopolitical stage. In doing research, I realized the different roles that the United States plays in different places in terms of stability, et cetera. And I kind of started to view them in a different way, right? So I still had my reservations, so to speak, about certain policies. And keep in mind, I was in high school during the Bush administration. So I still felt the way I felt. But at the same time, there were instances where I could be like, well, I understand why he did that. And honestly, I would do it too. Maybe things should be couched differently. Maybe we should go about things differently. But at the end of the day, doing research actually kind of made me change my stance on
it. Broader, you've got a more nuanced picture.
Exactly.
Even though you don't flip.
Exactly.
So let's see. I think we have time now. Maybe we've got about 3 minutes left. And maybe you can give me a sample of one of the parts of the debate and explain it for us.
Sure. So every debate involves a period known as cross-examination, which is a time period when you get to challenge your opponent by asking them direct questions about their proposals or their policies. And it's one of my favorite parts of the debate because it forces people to be unscripted. They have to deal with it in the moment with the spontaneity of the interaction. You see how smart they are and how they can deal with arguments on the fly. So if you'd like, I can ask Melvin some questions about his proposal he would have to deal with the United States energy policy, and we can see what that's like.
Let's do it.
Okay, Melvin, why don't you start by describing what you think would be a ideal policy for the United States federal government to help with our energy economy?
Okay, we would propose that the United States federal government substantially increase 1603 cash grants for hub zone, historically underutilized business zones, companies, and companies owned by socially disadvantaged individuals, being people of color, low income, et cetera, for the development of solar power.
Solar power, well, that triggers Solyndra. Explain to us why this wouldn't just be a Solyndra part two. Why would throwing away taxpayer dollars on a huge gamble?
Huge difference. Solyndra was actually a 1703 DOE loan guarantee program, which basically works by saying a company needs loans to develop any sort of energy or start a project. The DOE guarantees that money, right? The DOE guarantees whoever gives the loan, they get their money back. 1603 works differently in that they convert tax credits into cash grants. So it's upfront money. The reason that's different is because with 1603, you are not taking risk on technologies. Rather, you're providing money for shovel-ready, already proven technologies. Solyndra was, you know, obviously something that focused more so on technologies that we didn't do. Also, Solyndra was a huge company. 1603 focuses more so on community-based.
Well, you said shovel-ready project. That implies you believe solar is ready to go. Why not other types of renewable energies? I mean, or why not use natural gas?
Well, because of the fact that this proposal will target those communities that are most disadvantaged, and we need to – smaller companies would be better at doing that. It's a lot harder to find a small natural gas company than it is a small solar company.
You know, I just figured out how to make this show a whole lot better. Thanks, Guy. That sounded great. That's terrific. Good luck. Jared Acheson, Director of Debate at Wake Forest University, Assistant Professor in Communications. Melvin Washington, a junior at Wake Forest, a member of the debate team. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Just ahead, coaching clowns in Japan on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us.